Welcome, 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 friends. Kyle Tierman here, and welcome to another episode of my podcast. Before we get this going, I want to let you all know that you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter. It's a simple way that you'll never miss another episode, and you can get writings and ramblings from me all at tierman.substack.com. Just click the link in the description below this episode, and that's all I will say for now. Quick intro. This is a podcast with Randy Garrett. Randy is a spear fisherman, surfer, citizen mycologist, and friend of mine. He's been on this podcast many times before, and actually early on came on to do an episode that focused on swell forecasting and storms. This episode blew up because he just did a really great job breaking down how swell forecasting works. And he's just one of those people that is a super geek, super badass, and dives deep into every subject that he gets interested in. And most recently, the one that he has been diving into is MPAs, Marine Protected Areas, and the efficacy of Marine Protected Areas or lack thereof. And in this episode, he makes a very strong argument against marine protected areas in certain regions. And I was really interested in this because Randy considers himself an environmentalist. I consider myself an environmentalist. And there is a marine protected area that's being proposed in the Pleasure Point area. This is a surf spot and spearfishing zone that I've spent a lot of time at. And Randy said, hey man, I'd love to come on your podcast and talk about this because I think that this issue, whether or not you're listening from Santa Cruz or from Timbuktu, it is a microcosm of a larger storm at hand, which is a polarization between hunters and anglers and quote unquote environmentalists. And I think that often these kinds of conversations and these issues lead to further radicalization and polarization to a point where none of us are hearing each other. And I think that Randy is just a really wonderful spokesman for an issue like this because he breaks down the issue of MPAs in what I believed was a very cogent and nuanced and rational way. That's my goal for this podcast. No matter where you land after listening to this, I just hope that you can do so with an open mind and be willing to be surprised. That's all that I hope and ask for as we continue to get into this conversation. And I will also do a plug for a website, which is allwaters.org. If you would like to get more involved in this issue, allwaters.org, which was created by Chris Killen, and it's a place that you can learn more about this issue and continue to get involved. So without further preamble, I will stop talking. I hope that you enjoy this podcast as much as I enjoyed hosting it. Please welcome to the show, Randy Garrett.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
All right, here we go. Randy Garrett in the house. You're just saying that you're still getting better at surfing, yeah. Which I love to hear at 51. Yeah. You know, you gave me a really great piece of wisdom many moons ago. You took me by the shoulder and you said, Kyle, if you want to continue to have a really active life with kids and a job and the craziness of adulting, manage transitions.
No, oh, you remember
do
that.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I know. I totally
so what do you
know.
Mean by that? What do you mean by managing transitions?
It's that interstitial time in between activities. So for triathletes to be really extreme, not that I ever was one, I've done one triathlon in my life. They're super precise about moving from swimming to biking to running to minimize the time because you're still on the clock.
Right.
And it's the same thing is true. If you can't relate to that, same thing is true in my job with teaching. My number one priority when I'm teaching, I've been teaching for 25 years, is to put the kids first. A kid asks me a question, you're first all of a sudden. Whatever I was doing is now second or third or whatever. And so the moments when no one is asking me anything is a moment where I can do something to move the needle forward in another aspect of the craft of teaching. And then ultimately liberate time for me to do things like surf and spend time with my kids and go and forage for mushrooms or go spearfishing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would argue that you more than anyone I know, live a life outdoors amidst having a lot of busyness. Like I've seen you before where it's a school day and it'll be 7 a.m. and you will have already gone on a good long spearfish and graded homework from the 30 kids or how, like it's crazy. So what do you do? Do you put your spearfishing gear out the night before?
I have it all set up with, it's again, the transition. I have it set up in my backyard so that it's really easily accessible in a bag that I can, once I get my wetsuit on, I can sling it over my shoulder. A lot of times I'll take a inflatable sup out so that I can get a little more latitude, get out a little faster, not spend time kicking and kind of be tired when I get out, because the whole thing is about breath management and managing your inner cycles. So
not getting tired by the time you're out there to go shoot some fish.
Yeah. It just, everything takes a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. And not that I'm about getting as much done. Like it sounds like I'm about just rushing through activity to activity, but it's again about what is the part of the activity that I want to be focused on and surgical about. And the act of kicking out while beautiful and fun is secondary to the act of diving down and interacting with this three-dimensional universe that I can be diving down after breathing up and my heart rate's lower and be upside down and have a fish go by. And I've only done it once, but while I'm diving down, shoot a fish while I'm upside down. Like what hunter in the world gets to do that? I mean, I don't, maybe people do that while they're deer hunting. They're hanging like a bat upside down.
Not often.
I don't know.
I don't know if you know who Steve Rinella is. He has a Netflix show called Meat Eater. He's a very articulate hunter, and he does these trips, you know, where he goes out to these far-flung places to go hunting. And he went on a spearfishing trip to Hawaii with Kimmy Werner.
Amazing.
And he got out after the day of diving and said, I feel like I've wasted my entire life hunting. This is just so much cooler. Uh-huh. And I mean, each has its own place, I believe. I think that it's always been inspiring for me just to watch you move and continue to get after it on such a regular basis. We did a podcast a few years ago that some people may or may not remember. I think it was titled Getting Lost in the Wilderness with my 13-year-old son.
Yeah.
And it was a great story that you told with your son Jasper about getting lost in the Sierras on a mushroom foraging trip.
Yeah.
Despite all of the details of that trip, I just thought it was so cool that you so consistently make that time to go out into the wilderness with your son, with your family, or by yourself. And a lot of it, I think, comes back to exactly what you're saying, is just managing these transitions so that when you get a free moment, you can, boom, say yes, you have your kit ready, and then you're off.
Yeah, that's definitely My son is the mushroom hunter, and my daughter is the surfer, and Spiro, that she's into spearfishing.
That's so cool.
She's 14, and my son is 17, and so having the van ready to go with our gear in the wintertime and collection materials and storage afterwards and so on, it's particularly valuable. And there's just so many lessons to be learned in both of those mediums, mushroom hunting or spearfishing or surfing, interacting mm-hmm. with nature and being outside. I think it's definitely something that could be lost in the modern era. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's just so important that I prioritize that above things like, I think I have an Instagram account, but I think I put a picture up there once.
It's dusty. It's not well used as it shouldn't be. Yeah, man. And it's and also just having a family that understands that these activities like surfing or spearfishing or mushroom foraging aren't good all the time.
No.
Like, when after a big rain and there's, you know, a big morel boom, or there's a nice south swell coming in, or you know, a certain species of fish is happening, like, you kind of need a family to know what's up and know, like, yeah. Hey babe, like, this doesn't happen all the time. Yeah. It's really important right now. And you know, I think that you lucked out, you know.
Yeah, that there's an allure of the ephemeral in all of the activities that I have just mentioned that really are a big part of my life, surfing and spearfishing and mushroom hunting. And they all are like combination locks. And some of them are more rungs on the lock than others. And when every single number hits, then the lock pops open and the event can happen. And thank goodness I have an amazing wife who knows and what she was getting into when she married me. Yeah. She's a marine biologist by training and is now a nurse midwife practitioner. And I love her more than any human that hasn't been my child that I could ever talk about. And so I'm blessed to have that kind of latitude. Mm-hmm. So
you moved into the Pleasure Point area in the 90s?
So I moved to Santa Cruz in 1990 from Huntington Beach as a 17-year-old kid, which was a funny experience and could be a podcast in and of itself.
I'm sure. At that era, a hardcore place.
Yeah. It's definitely, it was a funny, awkward experience. And so I was in Santa Cruz for 5 years from moving from, I guess we'll call it Surf City, but we're going to make your podcast not PG rated.
Go for it.
It is honestly, compared to Santa Cruz, Surf Shitty, but whatever. The spirit of Huntington Beach was there for a while.
Yeah. And you said, I remember you told me that you, when you first came to Santa Cruz, you were just tripping out on how amazing the waves were.
Oh yeah.
And then also spearfishing, mushroom foraging. Absolutely. I mean, if you like doing the kind of shit that you're into, yeah, Santa Cruz is a great place to be.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was in town until 1995 mm-hmm. and then I moved away for 7.5 years, and I bumped into my wife, who's a friend of mine at the time from college, and she was living at the Point. And after a couple of visits, it's like, why don't you move up to Santa Cruz? I'm mm-hmm. like, I have been traveling around working in various places on the planet, and Santa Cruz is amazing.
Yeah.
And I think I should move to Santa Cruz. So we actually wound up buying our house on the Point in 2004.
Wow.
So I've been a resident on the Point since 2004, I guess, in New Point local land.
New Point local land. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
That's somewhere in there.
Totally. Yeah. And I was spoiled because I was born in the Midtown. And then when my parents split up, my dad moved to the East Side, mom moved to the West Side. So I had this kind of interesting crossing between these two worlds growing up through high school. And then when I was 19, found a sweet little surf shack on Pleasure Point. And, you know, it was just a few blocks away from the beach. Yeah. And that's where I learned how to spearfish.
Yeah.
First place I ever went spearfishing was Pleasure Point. And it was really cool because, you know, there's a lot of rockfish at Pleasure Point. So there's a lot of really beautiful kelp beds, which I want you to speak to, more, but just to have the experience of having surfed this wave, you know, first peak, sewer peak, second peak, all these great defined right-hand point breaks. And then on a flat day when typically you wouldn't be going in the ocean, have that be the best day for spearfishing and get to go down and look at the contours of reef that I had never actually seen clearly and see the structure for all of these great fish. And, you know, going out and enjoying a few rockfish tacos isn't actually that difficult, right? There's layers to the spearfishing game. I would still, even after, you know, 6 or 7 years of spearfishing, would still consider myself a neophyte, aquatic hunter. But to be able to just go out there, you know, dive in 15 or 20 feet of water, shoot some rockfish, maybe get lucky with a lingcod, and then come back and throw those fish tacos on a Traeger, something clicked in my mind to realize just how much fun I could have in the ocean on flat days. And I had never really thought about that all growing up when I was just so focused on surf, surf, surf.
Yeah, I absolutely get that. It was my first spearfishing experiences were in the 90s when I was down in Baja with a pole spear and just friends hanging out for a month here and there in the summertime. And then didn't really pursue it deeply until I moved back to Santa Cruz. And it was a friend of mine, Daniel Van Hastian, actually, who's no longer with us. In 2007, he's like, Rand, he's South African. I'm not going to try and mimic his accent because I'll butcher it. But he just basically said, you will love going underwater here. When the clouds clear, because it can be really murky, good visibility day at the point can be like 3 feet, 4 feet sometimes. Yeah. Good, because it can be zero.
Yeah.
It can be much better than that. But again, it's the multi-runged lock. When the cloud cover clears, so to speak, in the water, there's such a richness and it's so vibrant. It's like diving in the middle of the aquarium. And you mentioned rockfish, but there's rubber-lip perch and striped perch and greenling and lingcod and cabazon and just tons of fish that migrate through there that are so breathtakingly beautiful. And it's so dynamic. And it is a really blessed zone to experience spearfishing. And for me to take my daughter out there, who I think her first time she started bugging me to go out was when she was maybe 11 or so, in her surf suit with little short fins for body surfing. We'd do the team breathe up on the surface. I coached her through the breathing process and relaxing, focus on relaxing all the muscles in your body. And I would hold her hand, which is actually what Daniel did to me to get me better at this. So it was really sweet for me to have this connection to my mentor. And then when she was breathed up, she'd squeeze my hand and then we would dive down together and I would literally pull her down. We did a lot of this in the pool first, but then when we started doing it out in the ocean, I'd bring her down to like 8, 10, 12 feet and she would just grab a hold of a rock and just hang out. And then I'd poke around and look for fish and she'd point fish out. And she's taken a swing at a couple of fish at this point. And it's just something that's incredibly beautiful to share with her coming up and then bringing home and filleting them at our house. And it turns into a little bit of a biology experience as well. Looking at what their stomach contents are like, what have they been eating? What else is going, what's their coloration? And getting her to see that it's important to understand where your food is coming from, as well as what are you taking to eat specifically? Because when we take something to eat, it also comes at a cost to the environment. So there's this give and take reciprocity that occurs in this whole learning cycle. And I think that whole component of education and learning is phenomenally beautiful as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's maybe the ultimate metaphor of being able to work through the discomfort of not being able to breathe.
Yeah.
Like it is possibly the most ultimate metaphor of being human is when you feel that panic, to be able to get to know that feeling a little bit better through these marginal steps, and being comfortable without being learning to maintain comfort and calmness in uncomfortable situations, and to do that in a safe way with you and your daughter, you know, holding her hand, going underwater. It really is transferable to life skills, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely.
And then yes, also I think that, I really hate to say it, but most surfers are not environmentalists. And in my experience, most spearfishermen and hunters are, because they are forced to continue this conversation with the natural environment once they get out of the water and come back to home and are cooking up this fish. Those questions that you're talking about are about how is this fish interacting with the rest of the environment? What are its stomach contents? It just leads to a longer conversation around how ecosystems work. I mean, I won't speak for all surfers or all spearfishermen, but I certainly became more engaged in and interested in the natural environment when I started spearfishing in a way that I had never been when I was just a surfer.
Well, literally, when you are spearfishing and free diving, assuming you could do it on tanks as well, I suppose I never have, you are puncturing the two-dimensional surface and going into a new dimension. And to effectively identify, identify down to species and then sometimes even to gender, something that you would like to take and make sure it's a legal size that you're being responsible, requires you to get into the head of the animal that you're pursuing and understanding where it lives and how it lives and what it does and why it does and does what it does. And should you, and it opens up ethical questions. Like if you see a smaller male next to a bigger female that looks like a trophy, is it good to take the female? Maybe not, right? Because that's a part of your breeding population. Mm-hmm. So then you become a custodian. Mm-hmm. You become a guardian and aware of your environment and the habitat. And now here we are talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's jump right into it. I mean, there is an impetus for this podcast and it is a timely one. So for people who are just tuning in, have no idea about the issue at hand, fill them in on what's happening and this conversation that we want to bring out to a larger public, because I think that it is really it's just interesting and I want to know more about it.
Sure. So there is on the table a proposal for the Commission of Fish and Wildlife to turn the Pleasure Point area, which is defined to be just past Soquel Point, around the corner over to near Capitola, and also out in front of Natural Bridges. And there's another four other pieces to it. I'm not going to go into the Excel spreadsheet list of them, but to create MPAs, marine protected areas, out of them, and use this legislation that was created a few decades ago to make them complete no-take zones. And it's being proposed under the auspices of preserving kelp habitats. And there's a lot to unpack in that last statement that I just said.
Okay. Great. Well, why do we need to preserve first? Why do we need to preserve kelp habitat?
Yeah, that's a great question. Kelp habitats on the West Coast from Baja all the way up to Alaska have been suffering. They've been in decline for more than a decade, and it's been a particularly precipitous drop in the last 10 years because there's been this triangulation of events that have occurred where we have climate change causing sea level temperatures to rise, which manifested itself in a particularly acute incident called the warm blob, which started around 2014 and extended forward a few years and dissipated to somewhere in like 2016, I think is the consensus according to NOAA. And kelp doesn't like really warm water. It can tolerate a little bit of tepid water, but really warm water is not so great for growth. It kind of breaks apart and dissolves. In addition to that, there was a die-off of sunflower sea stars, which is an invertebrate. That's like any sea star, except these are particularly voracious urchin eaters. And it's rather astonishing. The number has stuck in my head because it's so astonishing that the estimate that mathematicians who do biology have come up with is that there have been a loss of more than 5 billion along the coast, or 90%+ of the population. And these are an organism that eat, in some cases, upwards of 10 or more urchin a day. And they've suffered at least up to this point, as far as I have read, an unidentified virus-sized pathogen that has likely they've become susceptible to due to the warmer waters that they're being exposed to. And so they're dissolving, they're breaking apart, and they propagate, they pass the disease on to one another. It's a little bit of a pandemic for sunflower sea stars, if you will. So that then, coupled with the fact that the urchins now have one of their main predators leave the room, the urchins go a little crazy. Right. They start displacing red abalone. The warm blob killed some abalone. There was a massive red tide that was tied to a no-wind event that killed off abalone. So abalone also eat and displace urchin in some cases. And so the abalone bailed. And then now the urchin have free reign on the kelp. There's some otter around. Otter eat urchin as well, but their urchins breed fast.
Right. And they climb kelp. So if you're out, if you're down spearfishing, you can go and you can look at a kelp stock and you can just see these purple spines climbing up it.
Yeah.
They're really beautiful, actually.
They are beautiful.
Urchin are, despite how destructive they are very beautiful and very avatarish species, you know, and that's one thing on a clear day with good visibility, you are observing some of the brightest colors in nature you've ever seen.
Sure. And there's so many different species as well. And the urchin roe are really delicious when they've had enough to eat from the right species. So the urchin have gone unchecked, and they have been consuming kelp beds, which is, and they will eat the kelp down to a nub, and any kelp that grows, they will eat. And then they go into a torpor or a sort of hibernation state and wait for something else to grow and then become active again. And then with the kelp disappearing, the sea otters are displaced and become more susceptible to predation from great white sharks and so on. And so you have this triangulation of events that have now conspired to drop the historic, as far as we can tell from our baselines, kelp levels down to, in some cases, more than 90% drop from where they were.
Okay. So this marine protected area is being proposed in the Pleasure Point area under the auspices that creating a no-take zone will improve kelp habitat.
Yes.
Also, it should be known that kelp is habitat for fish.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's not just that kelp is nice to have around, but it is the habitat for which many species of fish breed and are able to hide and protect themselves from larger species of fish. And it really does help create a thriving ecosystem. So really? As much as surfers hate kelp because, you know, it makes us fall on waves and, you know, creates these speed bumps, it's super important for the environment.
Yeah.
And if you see a big kelp patty as a spear fisherman, that's a good place to go to Absolutely. Look for fish.
Absolutely.
So this is being proposed, and what do you think about it? And I think that it's really, I just want to hear your perspective because I just respect your perspective, and I think that you would probably consider yourself an environmentalist.
For sure. I'm very much an environmentalist. My votes are environmental politically. My dollars are, I attempt to place my money in, I view those as a voting from a capitalist standpoint. So I try and be cautious about where my money goes. I support a lot of environmental groups. So yeah, definitely. The first thing that I heard, when I first heard that this MPA was being proposed, I was a little horrified. And yet you spoke to the idea of calming before you dive. So my first reaction was horror. And then I said, well, maybe there's some science out there that I don't know of. I'm not a marine biologist. I teach math. The way I teach math, however, is many times is very much project-based. So I have students going and harvesting publicly available data, creating predictions from that data, becoming familiar with lots of different things. We visit NOAA, and they should open up their doors to us. So because I'm interested, I follow this stuff. So I calmed down, first of all, and I kept in mind that the people that would be proposing this, they're on my team. They're environmentalists. We're on the same team. There are not enemies here. That was super important for me to like keep in my head. And then secondly, after doing a little bit of diving on it, so to speak, and after my breath hold, I started reading the papers that were being submitted to Fish and Wildlife, and there's one in particular from 2021 that was authored by Mark Carr and many others, who was actually on the original commission to establish MLPA, the MLPA legislation, MPAs. It turns out that the evidence for creating no-take or MPAs and kelp survival and resilience doesn't really exist in Central California. I don't want to get too mathy because I don't have my whiteboard here, but the data's kind of a mess. It's not strongly correlated. It's not even weak. Doesn't even look weakly correlated. Down south in Southern California, where it's a little bit of a different ecosystem because of the water temperatures and so on and the variability, there's a little more correlation. And up north, it's also not. It's not strongly correlated up north, but in Central California, it's very much not correlated. Mm-hmm. And one thing is for sure that as an anecdotal piece of evidence, the people that I know who spearfish and myself, you see kelp habitats without fish. Mm-hmm. That exists. It has a term. It's one of the terms is a ghost town, which is a euphemism for other things too, but that nobody's at home. But so the fish stay if there's kelp, but if there's no fish, kelp doesn't seem to mind. Mm-hmm. So, and the evidence in that report confirmed that to me. So it makes me scratch my head. And this is sort of like big environmental point number one. If this isn't being driven by studies that are being reported out to the commission, it makes me wonder from from what direction it's actually coming, mm-hmm. because I want the committee or I want the Fish and Wildlife, I want them to be making their decisions based off of evidence. And right. and that's a bit of a concern for me. Ultimately, now they haven't, obviously they haven't made the decision yet to make it an MPA. Right. So let's keep that in mind. So, but the concern is that if it's not coming from there, then where is it coming from? And not to raise a specter of conspiracy or boogeyman or anything like that. But it is unfortunate because should something like this gain traction, it does potentially compromise the reputation as a science-based decision-making entity.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, I think that that's important too. And for people who maybe are not as involved in this conversation, I think it's important to know that there's already a lot of contention around this in the greater California area through a proposal called 30 by 30, which is to designate 30% of the ocean to be protected by the year 3030. And this is, it's a very complicated bit of, it's a very, I would say there's just a lot of nuance to what kinds of designations will happen where. Generally, it is under the larger framing of that we are overfishing our oceans. That is something that is absolutely true and something that people should be very much concerned about so that we don't have species go extinct.
Yeah.
And fish is, you know, really one of the last species that we hunt on a mass scale. It's a very much unlike land mammals, where we had these meat markets through you know, the 1800s, and species like bison were hunted almost nearly to extinction. And then there were laws put in place through Teddy Roosevelt. There are now much more established hunting regulations, which have allowed many of these land animals to come back. So globally today in 2024, the oceans don't necessarily have those same protections. And there are parts of the world, at least, where fishes are being very much overfished. And it's something that I think a lot of people are concerned about. Is that all correct to say?
Yeah. Okay. Justly so. I think, I mean, fish is an animal group, not a species.
Yes. Sorry. Yeah, you're right. I was looking for the right term there.
No problem. The comparison to bison is really interesting because it's particularly complicated. I mean, they weren't almost completely extirpated because of consumption by recreational or even commercial hunters. That was and this is also slightly to the point, that was done with intention of displacing the Native American tribes that use those as one of their primary resources. No buffalo, no intact social structure for these Plains Indians. So it was another way of undermining the resistance that the United States was experiencing in the westward expansion.
Sure. So that's a great point to underscore.
Yeah.
I will say that commercial meat markets and the commodification of many of these animals did, take turkey, for example, did lead to the near extinction of many of these animals. But yes, I very much point taken on bison.
Yeah, for sure. And going back to my environmentalist roots, there's a lot of fish that I just would never buy in a restaurant. As an example, bluefin tuna, I don't buy it. Salmon needs to be like super meticulously sourced and only a little bit. And I also understand that some people make their livelihood out of these things. And also we need to give these species some breathing space from our commercial endeavors. So back to the argument about dissolving or at least undermining some kind of a social structure. This is one of the unintended causes unintended causes of constructing an MPA in a robust high traffic area like Pleasure Point. And that is, there's this whole community of Live Oak and South County, which includes Watsonville and Aptos and SoCal, that use Pleasure Point because it is such a beautiful resource to go fish off the beach and go get perch, or sometimes to go poke poling, which is to take a pole and with some bait and try and catch something that got caught in the intertidal zone. I've taken my kids out to go get mussels and limpets and sea lettuce and so on. And for these people in Live Oak and back and down south, it disallows access for them and causes them to, especially if they don't necessarily have deep resources, to either stop the activity altogether or to have to go and drive 20, 30 miles somewhere else where they can, or get a boat maybe once a year. I mean, I'm fortunate enough to have friends with boats. Mm-hmm. So if Pleasure Point were to shut down, I have shot a lot of fish in there over the course of my life, being mindful of, my own impact. So for me, if it never happened again, okay, mm-hmm. That's the way it goes. But there's so many other people out there that use it as an experience, like we had mentioned before, and my daughter and all of her friends and a lot of my friends that and their kids, becomes an equity and access issue, mm-hmm. And disenfranchising these people. And then we have to talk about the environmental footprint of causing these people to choose to drive 20 or 30 miles away or hopping on a fuel inefficient boat. Yeah. What you're doing is ultimately, at least nominally, increasing the inputs into the very system that has caused the temperature to rise and the kelp to dissipate.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's, you can get into the math and the details of like, well, how much do they need to drive here versus there? But I think the bigger point that I really want to underscore here is that you disenfranchise the next generation from recreating.
Yeah. And
like you make it so that someone like me, when I was 18, 19, I got into spearfishing because it was easy to access. So I was like, you know what? I can just go out there and I can, through this experience, blow my mind and have these moments that I will carry with me for the rest of my life. I'm going to tell other people about it. I'm going to learn about these ecosystems, and I'm going to, over time, be adopting this ethic of engaging with the natural environment that I just simply wouldn't had I not been able to become a spear fisherman. And I think that that's a point that a lot of people who are proponents of MPAs really don't get, is that the long game of this, when you make it impossible for people to go down and fish easily, is that you just get less and less people that give a shit about the environment generally.
Absolutely. That is 100% the case. You lose your next generation of ardent environmentalists. It matters to them if there's an oil spill or a sewage spill. It matters because they are eating from that habitat. It matters in a way that is much, much different than other users of that habitat who view it as an experience that is only to be viewed under glass. The intimacy of the experience is incredibly different. The way you think about things, I can see it in my daughter, in the way she views the ocean. And in my friends' kids. So Daniel, I've taken Daniel's son out fishing and spear fishing, and I can see it. It changes things. It turns people into, well, guardians of the environment. Mm.
So is the argument that there are too many fishes being taken from the Pleasure Point area?
No.
Okay, because I think that this is really important to point out, because if species numbers are dwindling to the point where there just aren't enough fishes in this area for spear fishermen to recreate, like I think that it's like, hey, sorry, like, but yeah, these things are just going to be gone if you continue to go out there. But yeah, that's not the argument that's being made here.
No, it's being made with the perspective of kelp preservation and resilience. And I'm not going to repeat what I had just said earlier, but the correlation isn't there. Mm-hmm. So the point has an amusing safeguard against at least spear fishing, overfishing, and that is it can be cloudy as heck. You can, I have swam into the bottom because I can't see anything. Mm-hmm. And I come up and I'm like, well, that's the only dive I'm doing today. And then I hop up and I sit on myself and I look around for a moment like, wow, this is really pretty. Mm-hmm. And then I go back in. So, however, in the last 10 years, I have seen, and this is completely anecdotal and I get that. I have seen, though, an ever higher number of in specifically coveted species like lingcod and halibut appearing. A part of it is also tied to the fact that we're not bottom trawling in California anymore and destroying our breeding ecosystems in that way. The other thing that we haven't talked about yet that is a really important and cogent point in the debate around should an MPA exist there or not is that right now we are talking about that. And we are not talking about a partnership that could be made to get rid of the urchin barons in Big Sur using recreational and commercial divers and their gear like happened up in Mendocino and is showing efficacy. And the thing is, it turns into a distraction. We're burning our energy on something that is preventing us from taking care of what I consider to be real threats, like the climate change threat or the urchin invasion threat, or we haven't even gone into the particulates and agriculturally related products runoff that occurs that is also compromises kelp habitats in various places. So, and then this goes nowhere near purciners operating in the Monterey Bay and swooping up and breaking up the majority of a squid spawn, which is the underpinning of so many of the migratory as well as residential fish in a particular area. These are real things that we should be talking about.
Right.
And instead we're talking about an MPA.
Right. That you know about because you are a spear fisherman.
Yes.
Right. So this is a great example.
Yes.
So what would you say just directly to the people who are proposing this MPA?
So I did see in the notes that there was some head nod to the possibility of it becoming what's called an SMCA, which is essentially a conservation area that where there is acknowledged recreational take, and in that setting, then what you can have is you can have people go out and spearfish and fish off sups and fish from the shore, maybe take certain species but not others, have it be a list posted. And if this is about species conservation, I mean, rockfish were looking pretty dire there for a little while, then we should be having the conversation about rockfish and, like, is it okay to be taking 10 rockfish a day per person, as opposed to should we be making an MPA for kelp habitats? So
it's kind of like a sledgehammer versus a scalpel conversation.
It really right? is. It's such a, MPAs are such a blunt instrument. And from a historical standpoint, there's just like some weirdness there too. Think King's Garden, where the king gets to go fish or a king gets to go hunt and no one else can.
Right.
So, and a lot of the preserved natural habitat, the untouched West mythology, it wasn't untouched. The reason why it looked that way is because we chased all the Native Americans away. And like in 20 years, things sort of develop and it appeared untouched, but it was highly manicured
right.
by people. People are not always the enemy here. We are oftentimes our own worst enemy, but we are not always the enemy. And that's also the story. I want to pass that on to my fellow spearfishermen and enthusiasts who go out to go fish, and commercial fishermen, that we're all on the same team, that it's really important to me. And we're not going to get anything done as far as preservation if we bicker, as exhibited in Santa Cruz specifically by the rail trail. So,
yeah, well, I think it's a good point. And I think that there is there are a few cultural storms that are happening here. That I think this issue is a microcosm of. I believe that there are some environmentalists who are quiet misanthropes, yeah, and they have this idea that an untouched nature is the best nature, and humans are a flawed species, and we just need to get the hell out of the environment, and that'll be better. And they don't acknowledge the nuances of what the ocean means to a spear fisherman like yourself. They're not engaged in looking at the stomach contents of a rockfish and showing them to your daughter, and in really engaging in this, engaging in taking fish in a responsible way. So I think that there are, those people do exist, and I have met those people, and they just kind of think that we humans suck, and they're hardcore environmentalists, but they don't want to talk about this in any kind of nuanced way. And then I think that there are blue collar fishermen who really hate the feeling of being talked down to. And there's this idea of elitist environmentalists who don't really know what the hell they're talking about. And they feel very much alienated by those conversations. So it's just kind of like, you're just not my people. And that creates further separation and further polarization between far left and far right. And the reason I wanted to have this conversation with you is because you identify as an environmentalist. And I think that this is an opportunity for the community of Santa Cruz to draw a really wide circle around what we have in common here, which is a love for these natural resources, and how can we engage and move forward in a thoughtful way that ensures that we can enjoy these natural resources for generations to come.
I think that was very articulately said, Kyle. And in addition, I just spoke to, all of the folks that use the habitat for recreation and for their livelihood, also speaking to the people that manage from the political perspective, to remember that we're not the enemy either, that we are on your team, that we are advocates for this environment in the most ardent and passionate way. And to speak to a previous podcast about with my son, the way mushrooms exist, they live in their food. They live that they percolate through their habitat. Human beings, it's a myth that we aren't like that. We live in our own, we live amongst our food. It is here. And the more we think that we don't, the more hazard that we bring to our own survival. And that's really important. And I think that's one of the big lessons that people get when they go out and they go spearfishing, and when they go out fishing, and when they go out and interact in the wild with where wild foods and where food comes from.
Hell yeah, man. So were there any other points? I feel like you made a lot of really great points here, and I want to make sure that people can digest them and engage. Is there anything else that you felt like was really important to say that you didn't get a chance to on the issue at hand?
You know, finally, one thing that I will say is that there's a group of us that are particularly motivated about this and about educating folks around this proposed MPA, as well as ultimately, I hope it becomes a grassroots organization to advocate and solve other problems and potentially even articulate with the commission in a different way. There's a website that's recently put up. It's called allwaters.org, A-L-L, waters, W-A-T-E-R-S.org. And then there are the meetings that are occurring where Fish and Wildlife are going and discussing these proposals. And these have real, you know, politics is local. And getting involved with something like this is particularly meaningful, especially since what I previously said, we live in and amongst our food. And the less we think of it that way, the more we risk our own survival.
Beautiful. So allwaters.org.
Yeah, allwaters.org.
Great. And are there any upcoming meetings or anything that people can learn about and get more involved?
Yeah, so there is a meeting coming up next Wednesday. I'm spacing. It would be the March 13th.
March 13th. Yeah. Okay, and even if you listen to this after the fact,
2024.
Still, even if you're listening to this in 2027, you can still go to allwaters.org.
That's right.
Is there a point of contact if people have questions? What's the best way?
I think we're going to be using this website, Allwaters, as the starting point. It's all so new and in development. The meeting's being hosted by the Kelp Stalkers of Santa Cruz, which I've only been to one meeting ever, founded by Tom Powers and some others. And
absolute legend. He's been on the show.
It's just amazing.
Tom Power, one of the early Mavericks pioneers.
Yeah, just grassroots, just an organization that's taken on the mantle of leading this discussion in a really powerful way. It's awesome.
Yeah. Hell yeah, man. Well, I'm so happy I was able to see you. And it's just a total joy and a pleasure to have met you all those years ago. You continue to live a life that inspires me. And every time I put my wetsuit out the night before, I think of you, Randy Garrett.
Thanks, Kyle. I'm just trying to stay relevant and keep growing even at 51.
Keep those roundhouse hacks flowing even at 51, ladies and gentlemen.
Let's not go overboard.
Stand up, barrels. It's happening. It's happening. We're going to see him at 70. Watch out, Slater. Got nothing.
I know. About that, man.
All right, buddy.
All right. Thanks
Super
for
good
the invitation.
You. Thank you. See you later. Bye. That's our show. If you enjoyed it, you can give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps boost ratings and allows me to get hard to get guests on the show. You can also head over to tierman.substack.com to get my weekly newsletter. It's where you can weigh in on specific episodes, recommend new guests, talk to me directly in the comments. It's all over at tierman.substack.com. Thanks so much for listening. Get out in the water, whatever body of water you're closest to, lake, river, bathtub, ocean. Promise you will make your day better. See you soon.